This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we will visit with Karen Alderman Harbert. She is the president and CEO of the Institute for 21st Century Energy at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. Also, the Lieutenant Governor of California is slated to be with us, Gavin Newsom. He has much to say about the American political scene, and his latest book is Citizenville, How to Take the Town Square Digital and Reinvent Government. Hunt Slonim, an American painter, sculptor, printmaker, and owner of two Louisiana plantations, is scheduled to be with us for a visit as well. And we'll hear from Zachary Carabel. His book is The Leading Indicators, A Short History of the Numbers That Rule Our World. Happy Valentine's Day. And now we pause for the news on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. Outside our area, 877-217-5757. You may reach us by email, inkstershow@wrkf.org. Our guest to begin is Karen Alderman Harbert. She is president and chief executive officer at the United States Chamber of Commerce's Institute for the 21st Century Energy Institute. Under her leadership, the Institute has evolved into a premier national and increasingly international organization dedicated to advancing a constructive energy agenda. Good morning, Karen.
Oh, good morning, Jim. Glad to be with you.
Good to be with you. First of all, what about Senator Landrieu of Louisiana being named the chair of the Senate Energy Committee?
Yeah, well, that's good news for her, for sure. And, you know, she has a really good understanding of energy issues, obviously, being from your great state. So I think it will be a very, very useful position for her and for the energy industry, hopefully. Although, as you well know, things are a little bit paralyzed in Washington these days.
Okay. Well, let's start with that. The paralysis, how does that affect energy?
Well, I mean, for all intents and purposes, maybe not so much, because as we look at what's happening around the country, it's largely, and the good news story about energy is it's largely happening in spite of federal policy. So many of the things are being done at the state level, including, you know, exploration and production of all of our newfound oil and natural gas. So, you know, I mean, the paralysis is a problem, but right now it actually is not actually stopping anything from happening out in the states.
And as far as Senator Landrieu being named Senate Energy Committee Chair, Louisiana's had that honor before, most recently with Bennett Johnston. What does that mean for a state like Louisiana?
Well, it means that you're going to have somebody sitting in that chair that has a profound appreciation for what energy can do to an economy, for an economy, constructive use of capital for an economy. And we have seen people in that chair before that don't have that deep appreciation for that. And so I think for the energy side of things, this is a really positive step forward.
As far as the issues that are on the front burner for the energy industry, what are the issues that are first and foremost right now?
Well, the industry wants to have more access to federal lands and federal waters. Unfortunately, that doesn't really fall within Congress's purview. It's the administration's purview. I'm hoping that the leadership, both Senator Murkowski and Senator Landrieu, can push the administration to opening up more federal lands and federal waters. This Congress, however, will have to start dealing with oil exports. If the administration's not going to do it, the Congress can. And I suspect that the Energy Committee will take this up under the leadership of the two ladies, so to speak.
So you're saying the White House has more to do with energy policy than does Congress?
Well, right now, in terms of what the energy industry wants, it wants access, and that falls to the Department of the Interior, ultimately the administration. So, yes, you're right there. They don't want to be taxed out of existence, and that's in the purview of the White House to decide that. So, you know, and Congress has a role in terms of oversight right now, and they will be exercising that right. But in terms of oil exports, which is going to be very important to your state, Congress does have a role, and I hope that they vigorously play that role.
Karen Alderman Harbert is our guest, president and chief executive officer of the Institute for 21st Century Energy at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. There is, of course, always a balance between energy necessity and environmental concern. how do we bridge that chasm without having great division in American politics and elsewhere?
Well, I like the way you framed the question, because you're right. It's energy and the environment. And I think, unfortunately, we've devolved into a discussion where it's energy or the environment, and that definitely doesn't need to be the case. I think you would agree, Jim, every one of us is an environmentalist. We want clean air, clean water, good use of land. Nobody doesn't want that. And so the energy industry needs to coexist with that. And frankly, you know, they are really the pioneers of innovation and have developed so many technologies so that we can extract and use energy more efficiently and more cleanly. So it really is a coexistence and a balance. And I think that we're up to the task, and the industry has shown it's up to the task.
Well, one of those issues that is prominent right now that involves those concerns from both sides is the Keystone Pipeline. Where does that stand?
Well, boy, is this a poster child of what's wrong with our nation at the moment. Here is, according to the Prime Minister of Canada, who said, this is a no-brainer. It really is a no-brainer. Wouldn't we want to get more of our oil from our friendly, big trading ally to the north rather than from countries that don't like us so much? But right now, after 5 years and 5 months, it has yet to get the green light from the administration. And it resides right now with the State Department, and ultimately the White House will have to either green light it or red light it. And I think 70% of Americans have spoken out in favor of the pipeline. So if the administration listens to the American public and represents the will of the American people, they will let it go forward. But that decision has not been made yet, unfortunately.
Well, the administration certainly doesn't make its decisions in a vacuum, and at this point, you're right, there hasn't been a green light. Why hasn't that green light come?
That's a good question. You know, I mean, it's really this project, which should have been approved years ago, has really been caught up in what we call in Washington pipeline politics. And the line is pretty divided between those that are for our energy security and then the fringe groups that are really out there advocating against the pipeline. And I say that intentionally because there's very few people that are against it, and it is some fringe environmental advocates that are against this pipeline. They're not against the pipeline per se. They're against the oil sands in Canada. The reality is those oil sands, that resource in Canada, is going to be developed with or without the Keystone Pipeline. So they've chosen to fight over the pipeline, but they're going to lose. If they win the battle, they're going to lose the war because the oil sands are going to be developed no matter what.
How do you see that playing out? Do you think it'll become a reality at some point?
Well, I think yes. At what point is the question. We need the oil. They need the pipeline. Practical things will eventually play out, but I don't know that it will happen immediately. But over time, whether it's this administration or the next, we need that pipeline. They need it. We need it. We're going to have it. So it's just a matter of when.
Okay. 297-5633 in our remaining time with Karen Alderman Harbert, President and Chief Executive Officer for the Institute for 21st Century U.S. Chamber of Commerce. A question from a listener, Ernie, about natural gas exploration. Louisiana has benefited enormously from this in recent years. Is this going to continue?
And you're right. Louisiana has benefited, as have the other 49 states in our country. We have low electricity prices, low natural gas prices, and that means that industries are moving to America because of that. And you look at in Louisiana, you have a revived petrochemical industry. You have the fertilizer industry that is back. And we look at the resource base that we didn't even know we had 6-7 years ago when we were looking to export natural gas from Louisiana. Now, I mean, import natural gas. Now we're exporting natural gas potentially. So it is a true game changer for us. And it's here to stay. We have at least 150 years worth of natural gas. And with the continued investments by industry in technologies, that number could double, if not more, over time as we have more advanced technology. So it's here to stay, and that is great news for us. It's great news for Louisiana. It's great news for our country.
Is it environmentally safe to have all this fracking going on?
You know, there has been such amounts of mythology put out there about, fracking being unsafe. First of all, I think it's important for your listeners to know, you know, we have been fracking in this country for over 60 years. We have fracked over 1 million wells in this country. That being said, there is no form of energy, whether it's fracking, whether it's nuclear, whether it's wind, whether it is solar, that is without some element of risk. And as Americans and big energy consumers, we have to accept that. But we have proven, and the industry has proven, we can frack safely. It has never been proven to damage your water supply ever. And that's from our own Environmental Protection Agency that has certified that. So it is safe. And we should continue to do it, and we should continue to use that resource wisely in this country for our advantage.
Karen Alderman Harbert is the guest for a few more minutes, President and CEO of the Institute for 21st Century Energy. She works with the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. James in Mid-City. Hi, James.
Hi, good morning to you both. In regards to the Keystone Pipeline and speaking about reducing the United States' general dependency on petroleum, I was wondering if the speaker could comment on the amount of oil that's going to come down from the tar sands in Canada that is destined for export versus the amount that's destined for actual use in the...
All right. What about export?
So, you know, the oil sands that are going to traverse that pipeline, and by the way, it's not just the oil sands from Canada. We're going to pick up some oil from North Dakota along the way, too, that needs a home. That oil is going to be used here. We have a demand here. There's no reason for those molecules to go anyplace else but this market. And I think there has been a lot of discussion about we're just using the pipeline to export this stuff to China or somewhere else. The reality is the demand is here. So we're going to use that oil here. We're going to use the stuff from the Bakken in North Dakota here. And that will lessen our dependence on imported oil from other places, like Venezuela, like the Middle East. So the oil sands is heavy oil, and we get a lot of heavy oil from places that, quite frankly, don't really like our values. So it's a good thing that that oil will be used here and displace oil from places like Venezuela.
All right. Now, there have been reports, and you acknowledge it, Karen, that oil is going to China. Are you saying none of it is?
It is not going to China. Now, can I sit here on your radio show and certify that never, ever one molecule might not find its way into the global energy market, whether it's China or anywhere else? I don't think anybody can certify that. But the market, you look at the market, the demand is here for that oil. Our refineries are set up to process that kind of oil here and use it here. So it's the market reality is here's the market.
All right, Bruce and Walden. Hi, Bruce. You're on with Karen.
Yeah, hey. I hate to change the subject, but the New England Journal of Medicine just came out with an article on mortality.
On mortality?
700 people in Louisiana die because they don't have health coverage. I'm wondering how the chamber, or as we fondly call it, the dollarocracy, stands on the issue of Medicaid expansion.
All right. I don't know that that's her issue, and I'm not sure Karen wishes to respond, but if you do, here is an opportunity.
Well, I think it is not my area of expertise, but I will say that we have long been the most forceful advocates for health care reform so that more people have access to health care and it should be more affordable today.
All right. Phil in Jefferson Terrace. Phil, quickly, you're on with Karen.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Jim, and good morning. I have to say that to turn the question around, I would much rather conserve. This is a finite resource here in our country and in this hemisphere and pump.
All right. Sorry, Phil. He says we'd like to conserve the resources we have. My guess is that Phil is not a proponent of the Keystone Pipeline, and I'm sure you hear those observations every day.
Well, I mean, the demand in the United States for energy is not going down. I mean, it's a little bit flat, but it's not going down. So we're going to choose either to get more of our resources from here or somewhere else. And, you know, we can continue to be more efficient and maybe use less energy, but the demand is still there. So I think it's wise for us to use more American energy than somebody else's energy.
All right. Well, thank you, Karen Alderman Harbert, the Chief Executive Officer and President of the Institute for 21st Century U.S. Chamber of Commerce. It's been a pleasure to speak with you, and I know you spend some time in Louisiana.
I sure do. I love your great state, and thank you so much, Jim. Take care.
Good luck to you. Thank you. 297-5633 is your number. 877-217-5757. We'll be back, if everything goes according to plan, with the Lieutenant Governor from the great state of California, Gavin Newsom, after this 90-second pause on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. Outside the area, it's 877-217-5757. InksterShow@WRKF.org if you'd like to reach us online. We're waiting for the arrival of Gavin Newsom, the Lieutenant Governor of the great state of California. Obviously, he is a busy man, and he's making the rounds doing some interviews, and hopefully he will be with us in just a moment. Fourth generation San Franciscan, he was a guy who was touted as the likely Democratic nominee for governor in California in 2010, actually got the endorsement of President Clinton, and then Gavin Newsom pulled out, ran for lieutenant governor, paved the way for Jerry Brown to be elected again as governor of the Golden State. And Gavin Newsom, a Democrat, was elected as the number two guy in the great state of California. And he is a guy at the age of 46 who is touted to be perhaps at some point a candidate for higher office. Good morning, Governor Newsom.
Happy to be here. Good morning.
Good to visit with you. And before we get to other matters, I do know that you have a best-selling book that's now in paperback, Citizenville, How to Take the Town Square Digital and Reinvent Government. This is something that is pertinent to everybody in the world. Bill Clinton says it's a fascinating case for a more engaged government transformed to meet the challenges and possibilities of the 21st century. Are we as a country ready for all the advances that are not only in place but ongoing?
I think government's on a collision course with the future, and that's why I wrote the book. We're on the leading and cutting edge, technologically speaking, of 1973. What happened with the healthcare website, healthcare.gov, is for me was remarkably unremarkable. 94% of large-scale federal information technology projects, 94%, don't come close to meeting budget or getting close to being done on time. They fail, in essence. And here in California, we've had some legendary examples where literally billions of dollars of waste and what some would argue fraud was perpetuated by the continuation of the status quo and old procurement strategies and an incapacity to reconcile the world we're living in from a technological standpoint. So I really feel this is code red for government. This is an area where we've got to step up and we've got to reconcile, not just technologically speaking, but culturally speaking, our approach to citizen engagement.
Well, we have had an example of how the digital world can be of a problem by virtue of the rollout with the health care plan, Obamacare. I'm sure this is something that concerns you and the rest of us.
Yeah, I mean, when I put pen to paper a year ago on this book, if you read that book a year ago, it all but predicted the debacle with the healthcare site. And I just watched it seem like slow motion and just mesmerized that with all the cues, with all the capacity we have, all the very brilliant minds that do exist in government and all political stripes, they didn't see this coming. You know, 46 of the 47 contractors on that healthcare site had been doing business with the government for decades. And, you know, you'd say, well, that's good. But on one level, that's terrible. You know, I'm out here in San Francisco. And every single day, I actually have my office in an incubator with 40 startups. I decided to move out of the state building a few years ago to be part of what's happening from a technological perspective. We're literally down the block from Twitter headquarters. None of these new companies, these companies have been around 5, 6, 7 years that are revolutionizing the world. None of them can participate in any of these federal procurements for IT projects because they weren't, quote unquote, incumbents. And so we've got to change the way we buy things in government. And we spend hundreds of billions of dollars of your money every single year purchasing things when we could spend substantially less by streamlining, automating, and recalibrating our approach. So these are things I highlight in the book. I know they can be dull, and I know folks say, well, you know, it's just not something that, you know, it's not the kind of stuff that I'm that interested in, but I think people should get behind the hood a little bit, look at the plumbing and the architecture of government, and start looking at where the real efficiency and real waste occurs and find new ways, I think, of doing things in a much more impactful way, not just a much cheaper way.
Gavin Newsom, the guest, the Lieutenant Governor of California. Now, you have a career that is significant in the business world, but many people in public life representing us as a people in high office do not. Is that something that is of concern to you?
Well, I appreciate that. I've been very lucky. I started right out of college, opened a small business, and today, you know, it's amazing. We've got 17 of them, close to 1,000 employees, and I say that not to impress you, but to impress upon you my good fortune, but also how I've tried to take that entrepreneurial energy and entrepreneurial spirit into all the jobs I've had in public service, and I do think it's important. Is it an absolute necessity? No, but you know what? When you do meet a payroll, when you do have to make tough hiring decisions, when you have to balance the books and you've got to reconcile the ledger, I think it does give you a sense that you can't just manage problems. You got to try to solve them. And I think the biggest challenge in government is we're pretty decent at managing problems, but we're not good at solving them. And our purpose, I think, should be towards solutions and not just trying to fail more efficiently on some of these big challenges we face. And so having that kind of mindset, not necessarily a business mindset, but an entrepreneurial mindset, I think is missing a lot in government, and I think we would do well to get more like-minded folks in.
Now, you were the 42nd mayor of San Francisco, mayor of the city when same-sex marriage became a reality. That is an issue that has relevance to this day in every part of our country. And in Louisiana, our governor was just out in your state yesterday denouncing same-sex marriage. Where are we going with this as a country?
He was down at the Reagan Library, predictably saying what he said. It's unfortunate. But, look, good people can disagree on the topic. It was 10 years ago, literally to this day, Valentine's Day, where we were 48 hours into marrying same-sex couples at a time when we were barely debating in this country civil union. So at the time, it was fairly an audacious thing. 4,036 couples from 46 states, including Louisiana, made their way to San Francisco over the course of a month. And, you know, whether you supported it or didn't, I think we certainly brought the issue to people's living rooms and TV sets and challenged the status quo. And now we have 17 states. Last night, Virginia judge adjudicated of the unconstitutionality of their law banning same-sex marriage. You see what happened in Kentucky this week and what happened last few weeks in Utah. So this thing's beginning to change. 17 states. And, I appreciate Governor Jindal, and I appreciate even my father, who disagreed with me for 6 years. He came around just a couple of years ago on same-sex marriage, kept saying, can't we just call it something else? I think there's an evolution here, and you've seen it particularly generationally. I'm not looking for political courage from folks, but I think the courts, not just liberal courts, but moreover conservative courts that are there to protect the Constitution are finding that there's nothing in our Constitution that allows us to deny people the same sex the ability to get married. So I think there's an inevitability here that we're going to see marriage equality in the rest of the states well within our lifetimes.
Now, you're a Roman Catholic, as is Governor Jindal. And Governor Jindal, somehow, some way, in his mind and in his words, is tying same-sex marriage to religious liberty. Do you think that's a political statement, or does he, do he and others really believe it?
Well, I respect him, and I pay a lot of attention to what he says, and I admire his service. I mean that, and I think a lot of his insight. You know, he's been out there promoting this speech for some time, and so it ran a little predictable when I actually heard it and saw the excerpts. That said, you know, I just want to remind people. In 1967, blacks couldn't marry whites in 16 states in this country until a guy named Richard Lovin broke the law when he fell in love to Mildred Jeter. And for saying I do, the judge sentenced him to 1 year in prison. And I think people need to remind themselves, you go back to that case. The judge in that case said the following, very briefly. He said, God, sir, God put different races on different continents for a reason. God never wanted the races to mix. That was the judge sentencing Richard to a year in prison under religious grounds. And so, you know, when the governor talks in context of religious liberties, I'd like to remind him of how religion has played a role in marriage equality in the past. And no one looks back at that and thinks it was anything but absurd. But 70%, 70 percent of Americans in 1967 disagreed with the U.S. Supreme Court. They thought it was wrong that blacks could marry whites in this country. And so we've come a long way, and I think you're going to see the same contours of change on same-sex marriage. It's a quirk of fate that one of our sons and daughters, Dick Cheney's included, and that's why I think Vice President Cheney supports marriage equality. It's a quirk of fate that someone is born loving someone of the same sex, and for the grace of God go any of us, and I want to treat that person, that soul, God's child, as equal and give them the same liberty and freedom in their pursuit of happiness as anyone else, and that's what this is about. And again, as I say, good people can disagree.
All right, here's a question from a listener, Miriam. Does Governor Newsom think it's possible for citizens to follow in real time their tax dollars?
I love that question. The answer is no, and it should be. You know, we're living in a world, the new operating system is openness and hyper-transparency. You've seen that certainly with Snowden and the NSA and WikiLeaks and everything that's happening from a gotcha perspective. But we're not prepared for that world of transparency as we should. Government still is opaque. Government is still, our default is secrecy, not openness. And so we've got to change our approach. And part of that approach is true transparency on budgets and allow people to participate in the development of budgets. There's some great examples I lay out in the book of participatory budgeting, where literally people are able to make decisions that otherwise would have been held in the bureaucracy by certain folks, and make them in the true light of day and allow people to make tough choices and see the trade-offs in terms of their contributions to their local department of planning or building inspection or the rec center down the road. And I think these are the contours of the future of a new transparent framework of governance.
We're wrapping it up with Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom of California, who began his career in the business world cleaning bathrooms and removing asbestos. Mm. Some people believe that you'll be running for governor or U.S. senator or perhaps president someday. What are your thoughts?
Well, we've got a great governor out here in California, and boy, I love the old Bobby Kennedy quote, said what the world needs are the qualities of youth, not a time of life, but a state of mind, a quality of imagination. And that describes Governor Brown. He's returning 76 in his fourth term as governor. He's basically running unopposed. And so I will patiently be waiting for his fourth term to end and perhaps find myself on the ballot as his potential replacement. But until then, enthusiastically being supportive of him and getting California back on track as a state with a $27 billion budget deficit just 3 years ago, and now close to $6 billion surplus, bond rating that just went up, and an economy that's finally turning a corner, million net new jobs in the last 3 years. We're finally seeing a recovery, and we want to prove that you don't have to be profligate to be progressive, that Democrats can govern in an effective and efficient manner, but at the same time prove that we can invest in our growth engines, and that's human capital, and reform our system of government to make it more connected and more relevant to the world we're living in.
Well, thank you, Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom of the great state of California. His book is Citizenville, How to Take the Town Square Digital and Reinvent Government.
Thank you.
Good to visit with you.
Bring me on.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
297-5633 or 877-217-5757. Those are your numbers. Inkster Show at WRKF.org if you'd like to reach us online. Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom of California is a man on the move, and I don't think there's any question that at some point he will be on the ballot in that state as the likely successor to Jerry Brown in 4 years. And then he's 46 years old, so at some point I think this man from California will probably run for president of the United States, just as Louisiana's Governor Bobby Jindal is vying to run for president in 2016. And yesterday, Governor Jindal was in California at the Reagan Library saying that America is a country that is challenging religious liberty through the White House led by President Obama. And the governor even brought up Duck Dynasty. And I don't know what President Obama has had to do with Duck Dynasty, but apparently this kind of stuff plays well in some places. And Governor Jindal is trying to win the Republican nomination for president, and there's no doubt that he is vigorously pursuing this quest. He has for some time, and now he's making no bones about it. In 2016, at the age of 45, Bobby Jindal will be trying to become the 45th American president. And for those who discount him, remember when Jimmy Carter ran in 1976 in Georgia? He was laughed off the pages of the Atlantic Journal-Constitution by Reg Murphy, who was the editor at the time. The headline ran, Jimmy Carter is running for what? So sometimes lightning can strike in some unknown. And let's face it, Bobby Jindal is still relatively unknown around the country, can win an office like the presidency. And Governor Jindal is a man of ambition and talent, and he has shown, among other things, a remarkable ability to raise funds. So Bobby Jindal is a person to be reckoned with as the Republicans round the corner and head toward 2016 and try to win the presidency for the first time since George Bush won a squeaker in 2004. Now, in the last six presidential elections, Republicans have won only one in the popular vote. Only once have Republicans won in the popular vote in the last six elections. And in those six elections, four times, Republicans have won the mail vote, have gotten a majority of the vote from mail voters in four of the last six elections, but yet have lost all but one of them in the popular vote, and that was a very close one. When George Bush beat John Kerry in a close election in 2004. Bush lost the popular vote by almost 600,000 votes to Albert Gore in 2000. Bill Clinton was the strong victor in the popular vote in 1992 and in 1996. And the last two times out, President Obama has won what amounts to modern-day landslides over John McCain and Mitt Romney. The last time was expected to be a cliffhanger, and Mitt Romney lost by 5 million votes. 5 million votes on a day when many were predicting that Romney would win. In fact, Romney, it has been reported, had only one speech ready on election night. Just one speech, and it was a victory speech. And he had to reverse field and deliver a concession speech. And now, as we look ahead to 2016, the clear front-runner among the Democrats is Hillary Clinton, and the Republicans are in a wild fight to determine who their front-runner will be, and the person who I think has worked the hardest for it to this point is our governor, Bobby Jindal, elected in 2007, reelected in 2011 with 66% of the votes. And he will be out on the hustings, not only talking about religious liberty or lack thereof as he sees it, but about the Louisiana miracle. Has there been a Louisiana miracle? We'll be talking about this in the days, weeks, and months to come. Coming next on the show, we'll visit with Zachary Carabel. His book is The Leading Indicators, A Short History of the Numbers That Rule Our World. Back in 90 seconds on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Our guest is Zachary Carabel. His book is The Leading Indicators, A Short History of the Numbers That Rule Our World. Zachary is an author, money manager, commentator, and head of global strategy at a company, and he is a man who has been featured in places like The Washington Post, The Daily Beast, Time, The Wall Street Journal, The New Republic, The New York Times, and he is with us right now. We're bombarded every day with numbers that tell us how we're doing, whether the economy is growing or shrinking, whether the future looks bright or dim, gross national product, balance of trade, unemployment, inflation, and consumer confidence guide our actions. Yet few of us know that these numbers come from different places and what they mean and how they rule our world. Here to provide some enlightenment, we hope, is Zachary Carabel. Good morning, Zachary.
Good morning.
Well, we hear these numbers all the time, and some of us have a cursory knowledge of, for example, what the Dow Jones Industrial Average means, but what does it really mean when we hear that the Dow is at 16,000?
What is it all about? That sounds like a broader existential interview question, although I have to say in writing the book, it did lead me to these questions of how much of our sense of what's going on in the world is framed by these very abstract numbers, right? I mean, none of us really have a personal relationship to GDP or inflation, right? We have a personal relationship to how our businesses are going or how our jobs are going or how our families are thriving. But increasingly in the world we're living in, as you know from your show every day, right, we make a lot of conclusions about the world that we're in based on a very limited set of simple numbers. And one thing I was struck by when I started looking at this was just how recently these numbers were invented and how even more recently than that they became part of our national conversation about are we doing well or are we doing badly. I mean, most of our history as human beings and most of our history as Americans unfolded without ever talking about GDP or unemployment or the Dow Jones or the inflation rate because those numbers didn't even exist. And they didn't exist till the 1930s or the 1940s, and they didn't really become part of our communal conversation about how we're doing until well after that. And that's very, very recent to have shaped our world so intimately by these numbers.
Well, your book is The Leading Indicators. So what are the leading indicators? What are you referring to?
So there is actually a very specific index that the conference board puts out every month called the Index of Leading Indicators, Leading Economic Indicators, and that, as you say, includes things like the Dow Jones Average. I was using the term a little more broadly about what are the numbers that we use to frame our sense of this thing called the economy. And I could have looked at more than I do, but it's, you know, it's one book and you don't want to overwhelm. So I looked at unemployment, I looked at trade figures, I looked at the Consumer Price Index, i.e. inflation, I looked at consumer confidence and gross domestic product and unemployment and a few others in the mix. You know, it could have looked more at national housing numbers or retail sales, but there aren't, you know, there may be a few dozen, but there aren't a few hundred there that we use really consequentially all the time.
Well, quite often we hear people refer, Zachary, to the debt when they really mean the deficit, and the deficit when they really mean the debt. And those two are very distinct measurements. President Obama, if you look at his record, he's decreased the deficit by about two-thirds, but yet the debt has gone up quite a bit. And I think that few people actually get the information as it should be provided. Why do we fail in giving a full picture of what's going on?
Well, part of it is some of this stuff is very wonky and kind of arcane, right? I mean, unless you're an economist or you're working for a company that needs these projections, as I said, these numbers are kind of abstract. And nothing is more abstract than the idea that we collectively at a federal government level have a debt of $17 trillion, right, which is an immense number. But then you think about the fact that our GDP annually is between $15 and $16 trillion, which is also an immense number. I mean, these are really big numbers, and I think cognitive psychologists have shown that most of us don't really relate to big numbers because they're just too big. So I think part of it is just a very understandable human – these are just numbers being thrown around, and they're thrown around by partisans to prove points that, you know, almost in the hands of anybody they can prove almost anything. You know, if you really looked at, as you said, the deficit's going down because we're adding less to our debt, but we're still adding to our debt. Part of that debt is actually government owing itself money. You know, it's like different government departments write IOUs. So a lot of that $17 trillion debt number isn't even owed by anybody except the government to itself. And no one entirely knows what that even means, right? Can you default on an obligation to yourself? I mean, it's possible, but if you lent yourself $10 and then you refuse to pay yourself back, what exactly would happen?
Right. But in the case of President Obama, he'll go down as the biggest spender of all time, but he inherited a $1.4 trillion deficit from his predecessor, George Bush, who inherited a budget surplus.
Right.
So when you look at money management, many of the people who praise George Bush are criticizing Barack Obama, but yet when the deficit is factored in, there's no doubt that he decreased the deficit by almost two-thirds, and George Bush took a surplus and ran up the largest deficit in the history of the world. So,
yeah, on the other side of that, it should be understood in the context of we also have a much larger economy than we did 15 years ago. So, you know, if you have a house relative to your income, and your income goes up and the cost of your house goes up, you have to understand those things in relationship to each other, right? I mean, if you have a $10 trillion economy, a $10 trillion debt is your entire annual output, right? But a $15 trillion debt in that situation would be much larger than a $15 trillion debt is when you have a $15 trillion economy. And I think we don't make these kinds of connections, right? And then you have to factor in interest rates. The fact is the United States paid more money, the U.S. government paid more money to service a far lower amount of debt in the 1980s under Ronald Reagan because interest rates were higher, right? So our payments, our interest payments on a much lower number were higher as a portion of our spending than they are today as a portion of our spending. But even this conversation we're having now, I think a lot of people we either have lost people or the numbers become extremely confusing because it is indeed quite complicated.
Well, you want to note some other numbers. The unemployment rate. What's flawed about the national unemployment rate?
What's flawed about it is the notion that there's this one evenly distributed unemployment rate, that if you went to a parish in Louisiana, to a city in Texas, to a town in the Northeast, that you would get this pretty even distribution of whatever the rate is today, 6.6%. And that's never been true. And we act as if there's a national unemployment rate that evenly affects all of us when there are massive varieties, depending on what state you're living in. At no point in the past 5 or 6 years have Texas or Nebraska really had an unemployment problem, whereas Greater Phoenix or Central California or lots of Florida or Detroit have had a double-digit unemployment problem for this entire time, even as these other states have done okay. If you're a college-educated woman, your unemployment rate today is below 4%. If you're an African-American male with a high school degree or less, you've got a double-digit 20-plus percent unemployment rate and a very high incarceration rate. And I think those realities, those specific realities, are much more helpful to figuring out what we should or shouldn't be doing about these challenges than the fiction that there's this national number that really affects all of us equally.
The book is The Leading Indicators from Zachary Karabell. You argue in the book, Zachary, that the trade deficit between the U.S. and China is skewed because of indicators. How does this happen?
So our trade numbers, which probably the oldest statistic any government has ever kept, are trade and farming statistics, because that was the primary way the governments before income tax got revenue. They collected duties on trade and they collected a certain portion of crops. But trade numbers today, which are largely the way we collect them, are a product really of kind of the mid-20th century, assume a world where the things we buy are made in one place, in one factory, in one country. And in the 1950s or 60s, that was largely true. If you bought an American car, right, it was made in America. If you bought a Japanese car, it was made in Japan. And therefore, if you imported that car from Japan, you were largely sending dollars to Japan. Today, a Japanese car, as we know, is just as likely to be made in Tennessee as it is to be made in Tokyo or Greater Tokyo. On the flip side, many things that are made in a factory, whether it's a U.S. factory or a Chinese factory, are really only assembled in that factory. They're not they weren't nuts and bolts made. Think of the new Boeing plane, the 787 Dreamliner, which has gotten a lot of attention because of all of its problems. That plane technically is being made in a factory outside of Seattle, Washington. But part of the challenge was the parts for that plane were being made in dozens of different countries and spread around the world, and then shipped to that factory to be assembled. Our trade figures don't really capture that, and they don't capture it for something like an iPhone that shows up as a export from China to the United States or an import by Americans from China. But it's not like that iPhone is made lock, stock, and barrel in a factory in China. It's assembled in a factory in China, but its intellectual property comes from the United States, comes from Apple Computers. A lot of its components come from Germany or from Taiwan or from Japan or from Korea. And none of that shows up in our trade numbers because it's very difficult to break down thousands of different products in the way that I just described. And we don't really have the means to do so.
Well, the book is The Leading Indicators, A Short History of the Numbers That Rule Our World, from Zachary Carabel. It is an interesting read, even though it is chock full of numbers, but a lot of descriptions on how we can bring life to those numbers. And we thank you for joining us today, Zachary.
Thank you for having me.
My pleasure, and happy Valentine's.
You too.
Thank you. Hunt Slonim is with us in our remaining time, an American painter, sculptor, printmaker, graduate of Tulane, best known for his neo-expressionist paintings of tropical birds. Good morning, Hunt Slonim.
Good morning.
Nice to talk with you, and you're a man who has traveled the world, as I stated, a graduate of Tulane. Live in New York, but still spend a lot of quality time in Louisiana.
Yes, I have two plantation homes there, Lakeside and Pointe Coupee Parish in Bachelor, and Albania Plantation in St. Mary's Parish in Generette on the Bayou Teche.
Now, the plantations, of course, have a history that in some ways the history is not so pleasant, but they are beautiful places, and I'm sure you've gotten past the past.
Well, these have redeeming qualities. Albania Plantation was owned by Isaac Delgado after the 1900, and he paid for the New Orleans Museum of Art with the sugar money from the house. It used to be called the Delgado Museum of Art and Delgado University. And he left all the land to, in the form of the Albania Trust, to the city of New Orleans. And Lakeside Plantation was given to the Marquis de Lafayette by Thomas Jefferson at the time of the Louisiana Purchase. So they have some redeeming other qualities.
Great, great historical places.
And great architecture.
Yeah, there's no place like Louisiana if you look hard enough, and you don't have to look that hard. For the scenic beauty that is here. You have embraced that with a great zeal.
I love it. It feeds my soul on a regular monthly basis. I get down there.
Pam at LSU, you're on with Hunt Slonim. Hi, Pam.
Hi, Jim, and hi, Hunt. This is Pam, and it's been a long time since we shared some really good times.
Oh, Pam Still?
I beg your pardon.
How are you?
Yeah, go ahead, Pam. What's your question?
I really didn't have a question other than just to say hello to Hunt and to tell him how much I've enjoyed continuing to follow his career and his escapades, and hope to see him again real soon.
Well, thank you, Pam.
Thank you.
And I don't know if anybody's had a more diverse life than Mr. Slonim.
I have a new book coming out in March called The Bunny Book by Glitterati Press, which I'm very proud of. I've been doing hundreds and hundreds of rabbit paintings for the last 20 years. And that will be coming out soon.
Well, you know, I wear some of your ties on occasion.
Wonderful.
They're beautiful ties. How did you get into this line of work?
It's very not a big business venture. A friend in Louisiana, Charlie Jacques, has had them made, and we sell them to friends and at museum shows and whatnot. We just raised quite a lot of money for the zoo in Naples with my show there. We did a fundraiser for the zoo and gave all the proceeds to helping them expand and take care of the animals. I'm very interested in historic preservation and anything pertaining to rainforest and animal welfare and children's education in the arts, which is sadly lacking these days in our country. It's just tragic. I'm an artist because I was offered art courses as a child in public school. It just breaks my heart that people are not having that opportunity today.
Well, you have you've done it with great success, a painter, sculptor, printmaker, and you have your own personal aviary. Not many people can say that.
I adopt unwanted birds. I have about 60 parrots.
Do you?
Some of them are as old as 75 years old already.
Really? Parrots live that long?
They can live to 100.
Just like humans, and they talk. Do you have any?
Yeah, they have a lot of wonderful, they look a lot better than humans.
Well, they don't age quite like we do, but do they speak?
Oh, yes, most of them speak.
Really? What did they say?
Quite a cacophony of words and vocal expression every day. It's kind of hard to hear. I've locked myself in the bathroom to speak to you. Otherwise, we wouldn't be able to hear each other.
Well, I know you had an exhibit here not so long ago, and you've got a book coming out next month, but I hope that there'll be another Hunt Slonim exhibit sometime very soon in our area.
Well, we have one planned for the Shaw Center, I think, in 2015 in Baton Rouge. And I'm having a book signing in New Orleans at the Martine Chasson Gallery, I believe, in March.
Well, we'll look for that, and hopefully we'll have a longer visit next time we talk. But this is a man who I think all of us should appreciate and we should know more about. Quite a gentleman, Hunt Slonim. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. I certainly appreciate the opportunity to speak with you.
Our pleasure. And we'll be back Monday. Until then, stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.